This is Film Weekly, and I'm Jason Solomons. On this week's show, we meet Ari Folman, whose animated film Waltz with Bashir has become a global phenomenon that began humbly at Cannes.
And Cannes is a freak show. It's a religious, extremely fundamentalistic religious cult.
We talked to Heather Krall about this year's Sheffield International Documentary Festival.
We have a programming committee, and when we all meet in sort of March or April, we always say, well, I wonder what's going to be in the zeitgeist in November, you know, and of course you've got no idea. In April this year, we were like, well, we know what's going to be in the zeitgeist.
I know the answer, Heather. Yes, I could guess what this year's big theme was at Chef Doc Fest. Can you? Well, if you can't, find out later with the producer, Simon Chin, the man behind that brilliant documentary, Man on Wire. Also on this week's show, Zan Brooks is back to participate in this week's quality control as we run the rule over Oliver Stone's W, Colin Farrell meeting Ed Norton in Pride and Glory, and Agnès Jaoui's sophisticated French farce, Let's Talk About the Rain. Only the words President-elect Barack Obama could make you feel any better. It's Film Weekly. Waltz with Bashir is a film that's been mentioned often on this show since its premiere at the Cannes Film Festival back in May, and with good reason. Ari Folman's personal exploration of the 1982 war between Israel and Lebanon is a compelling and highly original work of cinema and art. The film is a unique mix of animation and documentary footage, stylistically and structurally so distinct that it proved problematic for Folman's homeland, Israel, to decide in which Oscar Awards category it should be entered. When I met Ari Folman when he came over for the London Film Festival a couple of weeks ago, I started out by asking him if the complex nature of the subject matter had necessitated this new kind of cinematic storytelling, or had he, from the start, envisaged the look and feel of the unique Waltz with Bashir.
Honestly, I was totally clueless in regards to what I was doing. I just wanted to make this film. I wanted to make it animated, drawn, tell my personal story in drawings, and I had this vision, and then we struggled really hard to complete the film. It took us years. So we were really clueless about what was going to happen with the film. And then, you know, we go from that very small lab with 8 animators in the outskirts of Tel Aviv to the biggest stage in the world, to Cannes. And Cannes is a freak show. It's a religious, extremely fundamentalistic religious cult. Don't you think so?
I do. I do. But that's why I kind of love it, because it is a Fellini-esque freak show.
It's a freak. It's like everything is so exaggerated, and like you live and die on that screening. And then you have this 90 minutes of screening, and your film is launched to the moon immediately because they want it to be. You know. Yeah. So we were lucky.
Yeah, you were lucky. We liked it.
Yeah, you liked it, and the French freaked out from the film from their reasons, you know, and from there on, I lost control.
Mm-hmm. But I think that's a great thing, because in a way, your film is about control. It's about control of memories, about when they can creep up on you, when you can release them. Can you control memories and feelings when they come back? Can you suppress them? And can you keep them buried?
Yeah, it is. It is. I think a film, more than anything else, it's about where do memories exist after we try really hard to suppress them. And if they exist, if they have their autonomic way of living inside us, or then they can one day, they can just burst out, or they die. I mean, this is what I'm searching in the film.
As I say, the look of it is extraordinary. How did you arrive at that look? How did you and your animators say, I want it to feel this way? Because there are several styles that crop up during the film, one for the nightmare, one for the war, one for the Amsterdam section.
Very roughly, we have 3 kind of designs in the movie. The first one is the basic design is really realistic, and we try to do it as more detailed as we could, because I feared that the audience might not get emotionally attached to the characters if the characters don't look really real. Mm. So We did a lot of details in them, and they look realistic. It's like graphic novel, very detailed graphic novel kind of design. Then you have the dream sequences, hallucinations, that are much more free in terms of colors, proportion, design, you know, innovation, everything. And the last, the very ending of the film, the last 20 minutes of the film, they are designed in very strict, monochromatic way between orange and black to make you feel bad, actually.
Yeah, that works.
Thanks. It's a very melancholic, dark way of doing it. So it was a deliberate choice.
Mm-hmm. And you'd planned all that, or was it a process that you arrived at while you were working?
In animation, there's nothing spontaneous, mm-hmm. nothing. You don't improvise in animation because... You know, showing someone just, I don't know, smoking a cigarette will take you, I mean, it takes one breath of smoke, it will take you a week. So there's nothing spontaneous is happening.
Did you think after doing it, do you think next time I'm going to use real actors, it's quicker?
No, I'm going to use real actors because I'm going to animate them. So, you know... I've had enough of actors now. Yeah. I like the drone characters better.
Yeah, but I mean, you like the... I mean, there's an argument sometimes, I think, that computers can take over the world in CGI, in actors. But computers don't have memories like humans do. They don't have... You couldn't get the dialogue that you get without working very much on a human level.
My next film is going to deal a lot about the future of cinema. Mm-hmm. And I think it will change dramatically, but the story will ever stay. The basic story that we hear as kids will always be there, you know? And if it won't be there, it wouldn't work, mm-hmm. because people are really non-tolerant towards, you know, if you don't have a really very well-structured storyline in films.
So you know what your next project is?
Oh, yeah.
Can you tell me?
Yeah, I optioned the Stanislav Lem book. This is the guy who wrote Solaris. And the book is called The Futurological Congress. The title of the film will be different, of course, because we want to sell tickets. And
and it's going to be in Hebrew?
It's going to be in English. It's going to be most of it animated and part of it real action. And we're going to be with real actors that are going to be drawn.
Mm-hmm. And has that been a long... Has the Russian cinema, has Russian fiction been an obsession of yours, or is it just this book?
I really love the science fiction. Now, the more I want to say old, but the more mature you are, you read less science fiction. Mm-hmm. But this one, I always love this book because it is so crazy and intense, and it's classic for animation. Yeah. And when I started doing animation, it came back to me. You know, and I thought, wow, this way we can do it, you know, and now we're going to do it.
Yeah. Well, I'm very glad you did Waltz with Bashir in the way that you did as well, because it's a film that covers a lot of ground, I think, in his history and obviously emotionally as well, for you yourself. I just wanted to touch on very briefly, congratulations, because I know Israel has chosen it to represent Israel at the Oscars.
Yeah.
Please God, that'll happen and you'll be there.
Yeah. Hopefully.
But I don't know in what category it could be.
Both categories.
It's animation and...
Animation and foreign.
Well, I wish you the best of luck. But Israel has taken this film very well, it seems to me.
Israel is taking this film too well, extremely well. You know, it's like... Now the mainstream, it was supposed to be really this really extreme artistic movie, but now it's like the mainstream of the Israeli industry. So look at me, I mean, I'm the mainstream guy here.
Yeah, you know, and amazingly, it should. I'm sure it should be a big disputed thing in Israel. There should be a political fury in your film, and they've actually sort of embraced it.
Yeah, nothing. You know, it's like those teenager kids that they start to rebel. And they have really experienced parents, and this guy comes home and he's young and he breaks everything, and they say, okay, now What do you want for supper? You know, it's the same.
Maybe that's tame. That's the way to tame the rebel. Ari Folman, congratulations on Waltz with Bashir. Thanks for joining us. Waltz with Bashir, one of the most distinctive films you'll see anywhere in the world this year, is on UK-wide release from Friday the 21st of November. That's Friday the 21st of November. But if you missed it at the London Film Festival or in Cannes or at the New York Film Festival, you can try and catch it at the UK Jewish Film Festival here in London and around the country. For information and tickets, go to UKJewishFilmFestival.org.uk. And for another take on Ari Folman, you can download The Guardian's excellent Sounds Jewish podcast, presented by Jason Solomons. www.guardian.co.uk/audio. It's Film Weekly. I'm Jason Solomons, and I welcome Zan Brooks into the pod, The Guardian's roving film critic and writer. Politics and justice loom large in our films this week. Zan, we'll be looking at Dubya by Oliver Stone, Let's Talk About the Rain by Agnès Jaoui, and Pride and Glory by some bloke I've never heard of, Gavin O'Connor, a new director to me. That's a film starring Edward Norton and Colin Farrell and John Voight. But let's start with Dubya. Barack Obama is going to be in the White House. That's not something that comes into Oliver Stone's version of George Bush's reign in Dubya. Josh Brolin plays George Bush, Tandy Newton plays Condoleezza Rice, Richard Dreyfuss plays Dick Cheney, and Laura Bush is played by Elizabeth Banks. Here's George and Laura meeting for the first time. Victory for Barack Obama, something that doesn't come in to Oliver Stone's version of Dubya. Josh Brolin plays President George Bush. Tandy Newton plays Condoleezza Rice. And Richard Dreyfuss plays Dick Cheney. We're going to need a bigger boat.
What do you do, Laura?
I read, I smoke.
Uh-huh.
I admire.
You admire what?
People who write, who read. I'm a librarian.
Uh-oh.
No,
actually, I'm reading something right now. Yeah, a very engaging book.
Oh, what is it?
Barry Goldwater's Conscience of a Conservative.
Uh-oh. Jan!
No, don't tell me.
Well, I worked on Gene McCarthy's campaign and voted for LBJ.
Oh, no. No. Well, looks like we're hitting it off like grease hits a skillet, huh?
Well, I don't think politics should define a human being. There's more to people than just how they vote.
Yeah, I like that. I like that. You're open-minded. Yeah, much more so than me, I'd have to say.
And that was Elizabeth Banks and Josh Brolin, who is rather good as Dubya. Is the film up to the impersonation, though?
No, the film isn't. The film works brilliantly as a series of impersonations. It's uncanny. I mean, Josh Brolin looks nothing like George Bush, but he captures his sort of gulping, way of speaking, his sort of slightly fidgety physical movements absolutely brilliantly. Richard Dreyfuss is fantastic as the openly evil Dick Cheney.
Isn't he? I mean, he is the shark from Jaws.
He's
kind of
terrifying.
Now
yeah, he's
played
become
by
the shark, hasn't he? This slightly kind of desiccated, terrifying figure looming up to sort of threaten a war. And it's all good. Toby Jones as Karl Rove.
Yeah, excellent impersonation.
Andy Newton does pretty well.
I thought her Condoleezza was good, yeah.
Very kind of Uriah Heepish quality to it, I thought. So as a kind of acting masterclass, I think it's great and it's fun and it's enjoyable to watch. And it's purely entertaining.
But what's the film about, then? For people who can see Dubya, I mean, you've got a whole life to squeeze in there, and given that the last 8 years he's ruled the world, you've got a whole lot of politics to squeeze in there. What does Stone do? What does he elect for?
Stone elects for a little bit of everything, which adds up to a whole lot of nothing, really. I mean, this is a film that was obviously kind of rushed to get it out in time for the election in the States. And it feels like a kind of hasty, compromised rush job. It's a bit of a comedy. It's a bit of a tragedy. It's a sort of Oedipal psychological portrait. And on none of those levels does it quite connect.
Because I think that's probably where people will see the most kind of newness in it. It's in the relationship between Josh Brolin and his dad, played by James Cromwell, who always seems to play dads in these kind of actors play real life, because he was, of course, Prince Philip in the Queen last year. He's very good as George Bush Sr., but it becomes about, oh, poor little George Bush, he was just in the shadow of Big Daddy all the time.
Yeah, it has to kind of basically drag the actuality into the service of the fiction. So therefore, George Bush Sr., who, I don't know, isn't perhaps as sympathetic as he's played here. He seems like a very kind of wise, sad old man, counselling kind of great wisdom, and slightly disappointed by the what his son is doing. I'm not sure that's quite right.
But his son is a maverick. He's a drinker. He goes to university. He's always in trouble. He's getting arrested all the time. This is the kind of backstory to the.
This is the backstory. You know, it traces the life of Dabia from being a kind of buffoonish, pampered idiot youth to a buffoonish, pampered idiot middle-aged man in charge of, you know, with his finger on the button.
The opinions voiced on Film Weekly are in every way that of the critic.
I think a lot of the time this is quite generous on Bush. You know, significantly it downplays his response to 9/11. It basically has very little on the Florida election debacle of 2000, which basically got him off to a kind of illegitimate start in the presidency. There are also moments where, you know, Bush is saying, we don't talk to people, we don't want to torture people. And the sense of him as being this sort of, you know, easily led numbskull, as opposed to somebody, you know, who had a real agenda, who was driving it through. You know, again, with the weapons of mass destruction, there's a scene where he's kind of furious that there's no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Now, I'm not sure, but my sense is that the whole WMD thing was always a bit of a fig leaf for them to go into Iraq anyway. It was a way of justifying what they were going to do.
Does the film? I thought the film would do much more than it actually does, and in a way, I'm sort of seeing the film and projecting a lot of my visions onto it. I'm sort of seeing a scene where Cheney and Rove kind of say, well, let's dupe George into thinking WMDs, and then he realises there are no WMDs, but we've duped him anyway, that the establishment had used this puppet figure. However, the film actually doesn't do that. That's what I think. But right. It's kind of there because these look like puppets. It all looks like rather kind of, to me, almost kabuki. Because everyone's an impression, it's like watching kind of cardboard cutouts doing some kind of strange shadow play. The actual film isn't really what happened at all.
Not really. And, you know, this is one of the most closed shop administrations in US history. I mean, you know, for better or for worse, they did not give their secrets away. There were a lot of deals done behind closed doors.
Yeah, here. And you do get the opinion, the feeling of that, because there's a lot of
bunker
work.
You had the feeling of that, but because of that, Stone is having to fictionalise. He's having to kind of make educated guesses, and I think often not educated guesses, kind of dumb guesses in terms of what it did. Also, you know, the fact of it being such a closed shop and that, you know, you're inside the goldfish bowl with these people means that inevitably Bush comes out of it better because you don't actually see the consequence of his decisions really on the world.
Absolutely. Sam, I mean, I've got to tell you that I was very excited to see this film. I saw it at the London Film Festival. Stone gets up before he starts the film and he sort of says, you think this is going to be a really portentous speech, and he gives a speech saying about the man in charge, and that, in my opinion, he says that the life unexamined is a life not worth living. And you think, brilliant. Well,
here
he's really
go.
Going to be laying into George. And my God, was I disappointed by the film. I mean, given that kind of fanfare, I thought this was almost as much of a betrayal of an artistic audience as Bush's regime was of a political faithful. I thought this was an absolute disaster of a movie.
Oh, there's no moral equivalence to Stone making a duff film and the actions of George W. Bush. But I kind of agree with you.
But
I
mean, you're wanting him to kind of lay into the guy. I mean, he's
going,
a dead duck, you know, anyway. He's going,
absolutely,
for God's sake.
You know, Oliver Stone has always been a bull in a china shop.
Exactly.
He's always kind of rampaged through things. He's always created kind of havoc where he goes. And this is kind of discreet and timid to a degree. You know, something like JFK, I think as history, JFK is bogus from top to tail.
The film,
it's completely wrong. But as a film, it's fantastic.
Yeah, you get
and you're
swept
gripped
up in it.
And you think, yeah, maybe Lyndon Johnson did kill Kennedy.
Exactly.
When of course he didn't.
And you want to come out of a Stone
it.
Film like that,
absolutely.
Even Natural Born Killers, you go, my God, I shouldn't watch television, I'm going to kill everyone. I always think Oliver Stone is a bit like Emil Zola. He kind of paints on big canvases. This was his chance for a Jacques, and my word, that finger is a little finger, timidly pointed, wiggled up. I was very, very upset and angry by this film because the opportunity that's been missed.
And there's a classic scene right at the end, which is basically how we judge Bush, which is duplicating a press conference that he gave where somebody asked him if he made any mistakes while he was in office. And he says, no, I can't think of any. And then on screen, you're looking into Josh Brolin, you can see he knows that he has, and he's ruined everything and he's destroyed his legacy, blah, blah, blah. I've seen the actual press conference. There's nothing like that in Bush's eyes. He doesn't give a damn. I looked into those eyes and just see a void.
So this is the exact point. And given now the results of last night, we can say we're recording this today on a fresh wave of enthusiasm. I think this film looks naff, outdated already, and it's only been released in a day.
It's a whopping irrelevance. Let's just move on.
Moving on. Zan, let's talk about Lorraine instead. It's probably a bit more interesting than Oliver Stone's version of events in Dubya. Let's talk about Lorraine is the new film from Agnès Jaoui, who often works with her screenwriting partner Jean-Pierre Bacri. We're taken into the politics of a woman in the south of France who's being made a documentary of by Jamel Debbouze, the Arab comedian who's a huge star in France, of course, and it's just making waves in world cinema. It was, of course, very good in Days of Glory. Here they are in the south of France having a little French time of it.
Ça propose un documentaire. Parce qu'en ce moment, je travaille avec un reporter, enfin un documentariste.
Quoi? Tu travailles avec un reporter? Tu travaillais pas dans un restaurant ou dans un hôtel?
Dans un hôtel, je suis réceptionniste dans un hôtel. Mais je fais ça pour vivre, c'est pas une vocation. À côté de ça, je fais des petits films depuis
pour. Ah bon, tu fais des petits films? Mais c'est bien ça. Qu'est-ce qu'elle a à voir avec moi?
C'est une série de films sur les femmes qui ont réussi.
Les femmes qui ont réussi? C'est ridicule.
Voilà. Et on pense à toi.
There is Jamel Debbouze telling Agnès Jaoui that he's now no longer the servant in her house, but he's now making little films. And she says,
I'm glad that you explained that. I think you should have more foreign language clips on this show. Can we play some more of those?
Oui, bien sûr, Zan. Yeah, absolutely. So, he used to be a servant in a house, and now he's not. And she says, but I thought you worked in a restaurant. And he goes, yeah, but I'm also making films.
So it's like I'm sitting there watching it.
It could be, couldn't it? It's like I could be dressing up like Tandy Newton.
I think there's a sideline there. You can, be a star.
So let talk to me about The Rain, Zan, then.
Talk to you about The Rain. I think The Rain is a far better film than Dubya. I think, again, like Dubya, it's a little bit of a mess, but at least it's an interesting, ambitious mess.
I agree.
Agnès Jaoui, I think, is a very talented filmmaker. I was a great fan of her earlier films, Taste of Others and Commune Image. She basically is a sort of chronicler of French bourgeois foibles and a slight kind of multicultural sense of France as well. And this is a film in which she plays a feminist writer who wants to get into politics and goes back to her hometown in southern France and has a documentary team tagging along with her. So it's a film about the bourgeois, and it's also a film about the kind of personal and private space and the power of the media, and it's interesting.
I like the way in her films you get a sort of cross-section of society. There tends to be a sweep. Usually they're kind of in a theatre or they're kind of psychoanalysts in Paris. This one is quite different because they're sort of in the south of France, so there's a bit of racism comes in with the character of Jamel Debbouze. I kind of like this comedy. People have said that it's not as tightly focused as Le Goût des Autres and The Commune Image, and it isn't, but as you say, it is an ensemble, and occasionally they come together. Occasionally they're a bit disparate, and I think that's probably where the film fails. But there's some lovely comedy in there, or some really beautiful scenes where they go off to try and shoot the documentary in the sort of farm hills of Provence, and get caught in the rain and get stuck because they're a rather incompetent documentary team.
There's lovely kind of telling images throughout all of this. And its bagginess is part of its appeal. There's certainly a case to be made for films that don't have, easy moral lessons and a rigorous kind of three-act plot, that are kind of collections of ideas and kind of exploring and going for a kind of meander and a wander. And Jouet's films certainly do that, and this particularly does that. Maybe, there's a hunger for some kind of resolution and some kind of easy moralising. She's not going to do that, and that's fine.
Yeah, it kind of worked for me. And I like her co-partner, writer, Jean-Pierre
Bacri. He's great.
He's always a great acrid presence. He's kind of looks like he's sort of smelling early morning manure being put on his garden. It's just that. And he's great here as a sort of dad who's a bit hapless, who's trying to make a documentary, but he can't get his life together and he's having an affair with someone. Everyone's got a sprawling storyline that's connected to everyone else.
Yeah, and everyone's putting on a front. And the Bacri character is putting on a front as this very kind of efficient, slightly sort of stern kind of, professional. And yet, behind it, there's a lot of kind of turbulence going on there that's eventually going to show its hand. And he does that very, very well.
Do you like this sort of French bourgeois, light, sparkling wine of a comedy? No, we don't make this film. And as we saw, I think we said last week when Nanni Moretti was making that film Quiet Chaos, Britain wouldn't, I mean, the closest we come to this is a Richard Curtis kind of
rondelet.
This is
the thing, but I wonder if the fault is ours or British cinemas, if you see what I mean. Maybe we're making allowances for this kind of film. I love seeing these sort of films. I love the Eric Rohmer films set in this similar kind of milieu.
Exactly.
The bourgeois French film is one of my sort of personal favourites. And yet maybe if I was living there and seeing these people, the idea of going to see them on screen would be anathema to me. So maybe a bit of distance is what's needed.
Because it's your life, really, sort of, because they work in the media in a sort of way and they're part of the bourgeois, and there's no hiding that we are sitting here, bourgeois, talking about the film.
But to see myself on screen, I'd run a mile.
Absolutely. But because they're French and they're kind of all in the south and they have a sort of nicer time of it than we do.
It
we
looks
can
exotic
laugh at them.
And there are little kind of, you know, local differences that you can pick out. So, yeah, it's a nice kind of tourism.
Yeah, they're like us, only more so. And that's Let's Talk About the Rain. Shall we move on to Pride and Glory? How these people aren't really like you at all. Colin Farrell, Edward Norton, they are family related. They're John Hurt is the paterfamilias of a cop family living on Staten Island in New York. They're NYPD's finest. They're admired in corruption. They all talk in things about things like dirty cops. And guess what? It's a bit like The Departed.
We got to keep our heads up here, Ray. We got to handle this so no one else gets hurt. You hear me?
We're not going to handle this. What do you think is going to happen here? Do you think we're going to go in the basement with Papa and smooth this over? That is not going to happen.
This is about me. My command. So what do you want to do? You want to watch me go down in flames? Is that going to satisfy your sense of right and wrong?
That's Noah Emmerich and some other people with Manhattan accents who are trying to be big grown-up cops in Pride and Glory, a film which has been on the shelf for a couple of years because everyone said it's a bit too much like The Departed to release. Is it?
No, it's not. It's nothing like as good as The Departed. Also, it's nothing like as good as an old Sidney Lumet film called Q&A. Which covers exactly the same ground. Probably it came out about 20 years ago, and it's the sort of the Irish Catholic New York cop.
Nick Nolte and Tim Hutton.
Yeah, exactly. And fantastic, and cover exactly the same themes of police corruption and loyalty and brotherhood. And expletives being thrown around and people hitting each other in bars and you know, all of that.
And there was a film at Cannes last year directed by James Gray, We Own the Night, with Joaquin Phoenix and Robert Duvall, and his brother was played by Mark Wahlberg, as everyone is in James Gray's films.
It's a little subgenre of this, isn't it? And it kind of shows no signs of dying off. And probably it should, because it's a massive cliche.
Isn't it, though? I mean, I thought I was watching an episode of NYPD Blue. Mm. I mean, that's a long time ago.
Yeah, presumably there's still an audience for this. Again, if the Jouet film is a sort of bourgeois tourism, this is kind of hardball cop tourism, going through the mean streets of Manhattan and finding out, you know, where men are men and how they come to be men and how they come to stay men and the compromises they have to make, blah, blah. And so it goes on.
That's Pride and Glory. Zan Brooks, thank you very much indeed. What can we see you writing on this week in The Guardian?
Probably Barack Obama. Seeing as everybody is writing about Barack Obama, I think I'll jump on that.
Well, I mean, let's talk about. I was going to talk about it, but let's talk about the politics. Actually, will Barack make a difference to Hollywood?
Will Barack make a difference to Hollywood? I don't know. I think you could actually make the case that George Bush has been very good for Hollywood, certainly good for the American documentary. You know, his stunning sort of lack of interest in any kind of culture. Has weirdly created a vacuum that people have rushed to fill.
And the Iraq War films.
The Iraq War film. He's certainly done enough for people to be chewing over. Presumably Barack Obama is a harbinger of a much more kind of harmonious and peaceful and conciliatory time. And there's a case to be made, you know, it goes back to the Orson Welles line in The Third Man, that, you know, under the Borgias you had, you know, the Renaissance. Maybe if Barack Obama is a successful, placid president, you're going to get a lot of boring films coming out of it.
Maybe, or a lot of worthy films, a lot of hopeful films. I'm wondering how much you think this, and I don't know if I'm right or wrong in thinking it myself, but when I've been watching Barack's campaign, I've been watching him parade to president, and so dignified and so cool and so beautifully accepting the presidency and, you know, talking about change. I was reminded, maybe rightly or wrongly, of Morgan Freeman being the first black president in Sudden Impact, the first time that a black character was made in a Hollywood film to be the president, which was a very bold move at the time. I remember writing a piece about what strong iconography and iconoclasm this was. And since then, we've had a succession of black characters in power. How much has the movement of, say, the young black directors like Spike Lee, John Singleton, when they took over Hollywood and they put a lot more black characters on screen, has that had an effect in making a black man electable as the leader of the nation?
Do you know, that's a fascinating question, and I think it probably has. I think that to actually see strong, intelligent, idealistic black characters in your living room in Idaho over a 20-year period probably does percolate through.
It stops the fear, doesn't it?
It totally stops the fear. And and the symbolism becomes more, you know, palatable to people who might normally kind of resist that as symbolism.
The more dignified I see characters like Lawrence Fishburne behave in films, the more dignified we see Morgan Freeman. I mean, really, who's the voice of God, in fact, these days? You know, be it Penguins or that film with, was it Evan Almighty? What, the one that
Dave
Almighty, whatever his name is. Yeah, that silly one. That has kind of, you know, and the Shawshank Redemption in it, that has kind of, I think, sort of opened the gates for the white voters and the younger white voters who clearly have backed Barack to kind of say, well, I'm comfortable with this. It's not demonising anymore. We have black heroes on screen. And I think that people like Spike Lee, who obviously have been shouting their mouth off very happily, but can be very proud of the work they've done so quickly, because it really wasn't until the mid-80s that we saw characters like this who were noble.
And there's a sort of weird little real-life connection there, too, that apparently Barack Obama and Michelle's very first date was to go and see Do the Right Thing by Spike Lee. So it's Spike Lee what won it.
It is. Fight the power. He did. Well done, Spike. Zan, thank you very much indeed. You can read all of Zan's reviews, other Guardian critics included, too, at www.guardian.co.uk/film. The 15th Sheffield Dockfest kicks off this week. It's the international documentary family together up there in Sheffield celebrating the art and the business of documentary making for 5 intense days. Dockfest is both a film festival, an industry session programme and a marketplace. And the festival director joins me on the line now. Heather Krall, you must be palpitating with excitement as the documentary season kicks off in Sheffield. Can I ask you, Heather, why Sheffield? Why has that become? Because it really is almost an international hub of documentary makers.
Yeah, I mean, the actual beginnings of the festival were connected intrinsically with the beginning of the venue, which is called the Showroom Cinema, which I'm sure everyone listening knows of. What it was voted by Guardian readers as best favourite independent cinema in the UK.
That's right.
A couple of years ago. But basically, the showroom, when the bid was made to create the showroom out of a building that was going to be knocked down, and at the heart of that plan was to create the UK documentary festival, because at that time, strangely, the UK didn't have a documentary festival, even though there were fantastic ones in Holland and France and America and Canada. UK, being the leader of the world in documentary, didn't actually have a documentary festival and conference.
Which films, Heather, are the heroes of Sheffield? Which ones get touted around?
We've premiered all sorts of films over the years. We've premiered Michael Moore. We've premiered Enron, the smartest guys in the room.
Which Alex then, Gibney.
You know, but we also celebrate the great filmmakers. This year we're having a retrospective of Nick Broomfield. We've also got D.A. Pennybaker coming.
D.A. Pennybaker is coming to Sheffield?
He is.
This is the man who followed Dylan and Don't Look Back. One of the rock documentary.
It is, yeah. It defined a genre. I mean, we have a programming committee and a sort of group of people that help advise on the programming. And when we all meet in sort of March or April, we always say, well, I wonder what's going to be in the zeitgeist in November. You know, and of course you've got no idea. But in April this year, we were like, well, we know what's going to be in the zeitgeist.
I know the answer, Heather. Is it to do with America and voting?
Exactly.
Oh, so brilliant.
Exactly. So they'd announced their election and we'd already announced our dates, and it was like, okay, so the day we open is the day the president is announced. So we decided to program a whole series of films around regime change.
Pennebaker. Is he giving a talk?
He's launching his brand new film called The Return of the War Room, which is following Hillary's campaign. He famously made the original The War Room, which was following Bill Clinton's campaign the year he won. So this was the return of The War Room, and I'm sure Pennybaker was hoping that Hillary was going to be the one. But obviously this time it had a different ending. He'll also do a masterclass, and that's the thing that people love coming up to Sheffield for, is we have all sorts of sessions that are about buyers and how to get the money and so on. But we also always have lots and lots of masterclasses celebrating the art of documentary.
Heather Krall, the festival director of the Sheffield Dockfest there. She mentioned there that there'll be various masterclasses up at Sheffield, and one of them is going to be given by James Marsh, director of Man on Wire, a film which we're very, very fond of here on Film Weekly. And as if by magic, the producer of Man on Wire, Simon Chin, joins me in the pod now. But before we hear from Simon, let's have a little reminisce about that high wire walk between the Twin Towers of Manhattan.
Somebody is coming on the roof. Jean-Francois hears also, and he hides immediately. And I see him, he's like a dead animal. As a child, have you ever played hide and seek in a park and take refuge behind a giant tree trunk? And a policeman comes to the roof. And then your companion comes, circle the trunk. He walks, you walk. He stops, you stop. The man starts turning around this obstacle in the center of my tower, and I turn around on the side diametrically opposed. This little pas de deux could go on forever until one of you turn around and bump into each other. Well, this is exactly what happened. He turns, I turn. He stops, I stop. He go on, I go on. Now, of course, if he would have turned around, oops, hide and seek.
Simon Chin, producer of Man on Wire, congratulations again. It is my favourite film of the year so far.
Well,
so,
that's very kind of you to say so.
Well, and
thanks for your support.
Well, we had James on, we had Philippe Petit on, and it's nice to get the producer on here, because I think people don't know, certainly in documentaries, how much work the producer actually does. I mean, this is your idea, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, producers, you know, we just basically raise the money and then go out for lots of expensive lunches, of course. But no, I mean, I did have the idea. I came across Philippe fortuitously one morning in, I think it was April 2005, he happened to sort of I'd overslept, and he was on the radio on Desert Island Discs, and I was awoken by him, this kind of mad, quixotic Frenchman, and I just sort of sat up in bed and thought, scratched my head and thought, wow, you know, this guy needs a documentary.
Mm-hmm. I mean, because what you did was create a film that has done well on the documentary circuit as well, from BritDoc and to Sheffield. But what I loved about it is that it's been such a success in the cinema, and presumably you, as the Money Man producer, probably enjoyed that success in cinemas as much too.
Yeah, I mean, I think we all kind of hoped. I mean, you kind of embark upon these things slightly, with a heavy heart, and kind of knowing how much work it's going to be. And you know, the documentary market has struggled, to be fair, in recent years. A lot of docs that were thought to do very well and sort of herald a brave new world have kind of underperformed. So we were ecstatic that audiences sort of responded to Man on Wire in the way that they did, and that they kind of came in their droves.
And as a producer, how much collaboration did you do between the protagonist, which I'm going to call James Marsh, the director, and the man who holds the key to it all, Philippe Petit, getting him to commit himself to screen? How much work do you do, going between the two, smoothing the pathway, the tightrope between the two, if I may?
Yeah, I mean, the producer's job is often one of, it's kind of, you know, I think you probably need fairly honed diplomatic skills, and you know, they definitely came into play here. Not insofar as James was a delight to work with. He's an extremely collaborative, sort of thoughtful director, and very skillful. Philippe, you know, had his own ideas.
Yes.
And the challenge for us was to kind of harness the best ones, and kind of find a way to sort of gently explain to him that some of the other ideas might not work. And that wasn't always an easy process.
Simon, you're going to go up to Sheffield with James. You're on a panel that I think is of particular interest to people who are documentary makers. I know a lot of them listen to this show. Thank you. And hello out there if you're listening. What's the panel discussion, and where's documentary making in the UK now?
Yeah, well, John Smithson, the producer of Touching the Void, had the sort of rather provocative idea to do a panel entitled Theatrical Documentaries RIP. I'm actually producing the panel and taking part in it, and we've got a number of luminaries, including John Batsek, the Oscar-winning producer of One Day in September. Jess Search from the British Documentary Film Foundation is chairing. So it should be a kind of sparky occasion. I'd like to kind of inject a little bit of optimism off the back of Man on Wire into the discussion.
Yeah, you're sort
and
of
I'm
living
sure that
proof.
John will be as curmudgeonly as he normally is.
So are documentaries Lazarus-like, risen from the dead, or are they zombies? Are you still walking dead?
I think it's somewhere in the middle. I think there are still opportunities for documentary makers, for ambitious documentary makers, to bring docs to the big screen that find big audiences. But I think the challenges are, you know, they're few and far between these films. And, I think, you know, the moon and the stars have to be aligned.
Simon Chin, producer of Man on Wire, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Well, that's it for this week. Thanks to all my guests, to Ari Folman, to Zan Brooks, of course, to Heather Kroll from the Sheffield Dockfest, and for Simon Chin, producer of Man on Wire. Do share your reviews of this week's releases or on any of these subjects brought up in the podcast. You can post on the Guardian website, or you can befriend me on Facebook. Search for Solomon's Film Weekly Cinephiles and keep in touch. Oh, we are high-tech here at Film Weekly. And, of course, for my trailer trash column and an article on the state of French cinema, including Agnès Jaoui, go and buy The Observer this Sunday. But for now, from me, Jason Solomons, and my producer, Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.